I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together, we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain, and once more it's one of our specials, and I'm joined not only by Peter Hart but by the lovely Nikolai Everholst.
And we're talking
once more, well, perhaps not so much about Austro-Hungary, but Austro-Hungary in the Eastern Front 1918, because it's all over. It's finished, isn't it, Nikolai?
No, not really. And we ended last time in 17 with the armistice talks beginning, at least, and the armistice commission on behalf of the new Bolshevik government making contact to the central powers about making peace. And you would think that it's all over, but as we'll find out, since we have a whole hour to do more, it doesn't really end just there.
And it's not just Russia that wants it to end, is it?
No, it isn't. It isn't. It really is very much a two-sided thing, because you have let's start with Russia, and then we can go into the central powers, because you have the Bolsheviks taking power in Russia in October, and what they do one of the ways to sort of convince the people to join them is this promise of peace, bread, and land. And as you can hear, one of them is peace. This is the promise that you will end the war with the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians and the Turks and everybody, the entire world that they're at war with. Leon Trotsky, who is the new Bolshevik Minister of Foreign Affairs and soon to be the head of the Red Army, he will be the man who's behind these talks and will be the one who really takes charge in this. He's not the one at the talks, but he's the one running the show in the background. Of course, as you say, it isn't only the Russians who want peace, because the Central Powers are beat at this point. We've said this many times for both of them at this point. But let's start with Austria-Hungary, because as you also rightly says, this is not going to be as much about Austria-Hungary, because they are on their way out of not only the Eastern Front, but on the way out of the war or history, really, because they have very little time left. And it's been like that since the Brusilo Offensive 1916, where the Germans take power and supreme command of the Eastern Front, also of the Austro-Hungarians. And starting 1917, Austria-Hungary begins to focus more just on Italy alone. And they will need that going forward. Austria is also ending a really tough period of shortages of food. There's nothing on the home front. There's no ammunition. There's no uniforms. There's no men. There's no guns. There's anything really. So their main focus is now going to be on knocking Italy out of the war. And they also just had a major offensive in the Caporetto Offensive in October, November 1917. That's where their focus is going to be.
But the Germans, now that's the one that they also want. They want peace in the Eastern Front. They're not that peaceful on the Western Front.
Nope. As I think we mentioned last time as well, the Germans are getting more and more concerned about this prospect of the Americans coming in, and they really want to end the war in the East to then transfer troops to the West and then launch some kind of war-winning offensive with all the men and material that is freed up there. So there are quite high hopes that this is going to be a change for the Central Powers, this victory in the East, that you can end the war and both bring food to the home front and transfer troops to other parts of the front.
Now, given that everybody seemed to want this, how did the armistice talks break down then?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the thing is that... Once the talks get going, the Russians sort of figure out very quickly that, oh, we're going to lose a lot. they're very hungry. And we're going to lose a lot of territory if we sign these agreements. This is going to include much of Russian farmland and industry and population. So they really much begin to realize the cost of peace, for them. And it might be too high, despite this being a number one priority for them. In all, Germany wants 150,000 square kilometers of some of the most important farmland and industrial centers. I mean, remember, Russia at this point, the big cities is Riga, Warsaw, Minsk, Kiev, all these parts of the East. Those are the parts that Germany wants in these talks. And then there's also the problem.
That's it. The complications.
Yeah.
It's been out. I don't suppose you've heard of this place, Gary. It's a place called the Ukraine.
Oh, what's happening in Ukraine?
Part of Russia, isn't it?
Oh, be careful, Pete. There's
a move to independence, isn't there?
Gary.
It's repeating itself.
Yes. Like your tea.
Yes. So while all this is happening, these talks, there's also something else going on because things are happening in the Ukraine. Because remember, as soon as the Bolsheviks take power in Russia, civil war breaks out. And this is ongoing as the peace talks commence. That's one of the reasons why the Bolsheviks really want to finish this talk and then also move on to fight their own war and fight all these remnants of the Tsarists or the Whites or whatever, all these fragmentary groups that are there. And there's also movement for independence in Ukraine. In 1917, the Ukrainian People's Republic, which sounds very communistic and all that to us today, but it isn't really the declaration of independence. And almost immediately, the fighting breaks out between Ukrainians and Bolsheviks. But it's also important to remember this is not just like Ukraine versus Russians. This is also some liberalism, conservative groupings that are mixed up together, going against Ukrainians that are communists or Bolsheviks. So it's very, very, very complicated. Basically, you end up with two governments. You end up with a government in Kiev and one in Kharkiv. And very quickly, the Bolsheviks move and take off all these industrial things that we've heard of daily now, Odessa, Nikolaev, Yekaterinburg, today Dnipro, and Kiev is captured in February as well. So this leads to this Ukrainian People's Republic asking for Central Power help. And that complicates things because the Central Powers are getting tired of the Bolsheviks dragging their feet because they don't really want to sign this massive amount of land over to them. So they make a separate peace, what is known as the bread peace. The bread comes because Ukraine is saying, all right, if you support us in our independence, we'll give you food. And the Central Powers are in much need of this food. So they signed this agreement on the night between the 8th and 9th of February, in which the Central Power promised to guarantee Ukrainian independence and military protection from the Bolsheviks in exchange for grain. And that's where the term comes from.
Speaking,
and this marks a lot of Russian resentment.
I'd just like to point out today's date is the 9th of February. Well, it isn't.
It is the 9th of February.
It's not when you hear the podcast, but...
Idiot.
Yeah, but yes, this sparks a lot of anger in the Bolshevik camp because, as we mentioned, the Bolsheviks have already taken control of most of the Ukraine, and now they've also taken the capital, and now it seems like fighting is going to continue over this. And at the same time, the Germans sent their final, this is our final terms. So what are they going to do? And that's where a very strange decision comes in. And that's this Trotsky's idea of this no war and no peace, which he proposes on the 10th of February. And this is the idea, because they cannot accept these terms, but they also don't want to continue the war. So what they're going to do, what he proposes that they're going to do, is that instead of doing this, they should just stop fighting, but not sign any agreement. Basically, that's it. It should be said there are plenty within the Bolshevik government who wants to continue fighting. There are also some who just wants to give away everything and end the war. But that's what they go with. They say, okay, let's just stall it. Let's not sign anything, but let's not fight. Let's start demobilization and disengage.
And realistically, was their army in any sort of position to fight?
Not really. I mean, the Red Army, there's going to be a credible fighting force within a couple of years, fighting and winning a civil war, it's still very fragmented. And they are not really in any position to do much. But especially not when you start this feet dragging. And for a few days, this seems to be working, this feet dragging and not doing anything. But then on the 16th of February, the Germans have had enough of this, and they simply say, all right, we're going to end this. Finally, we're tired of waiting, and we really need to end this war now. We're already in February of 1918, and remember, the spring offensive is coming in March, so we're not that far away from that. So on the 16th of February, they announce a resumption of hostilities against the Bolsheviks. They're going to break off these peace talks, and they're just going to launch a massive operation. This is what becomes known as Operation Faustschlag, which means like Operation Fist Punch. And this is not something that we hear a lot about, but it is an absolutely fascinating conflict and enormous in scope. It is, and this is where the next war is going to sound very familiar now coming in, because we have a three-pronged offensive into Russia. We have one attack in the north into the Baltics. We have one attack in the center into what is today Belarus, aiming at Minsk, and we have one attack in the south into the Ukraine. So that sounds pretty familiar to something anybody has heard about in the Second War.
Yeah.
And there is, yes, as Gary pointed out, there's not really any resistance from the enemy here. They are just simply abandoning their positions. This announcement of no war, no peace has created a lot of confusion. They don't really know what to do, the soldiers, and a lot of them are just abandoning the fight without. And parts of the front that have been locked for years suddenly opening up. And this is what we hear in the next quote, but Hauptmann Fritz Wengler of the Landwehr Infantry Regiment number 48. He is located in, if you think back a couple of episodes, the part of the front where the Lake Narod offensive was fought in the beginning of 1916.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the front has been stagnated there since 15. There's nothing has happened there.
This is Hauptmann Fritz Wengler. On February 19th, the battalions received orders to keep ready to march and to patrol the Russian positions. In the blazing sunshine and 15 degrees below zero, shock troops crossed the main enemy lines. They found it abandoned. Trotsky had made good on his declaration, and the demobilization that had begun would not be changed by the resumption of the state of war. At noon, a patrol of the 1st Battalion stood on the Maritichi height and enjoyed the uninhibited look into every fold and every corner of the German positions, which the Russian artillery had always benefited from in the days of fighting. On February the 20th at 6 a.m, a detachment set out. Guns and vehicles laboriously worked their way through the maze of trenches of the German and Russian positions. Around 11 o'clock, 2nd Battalion of the 48th arrived in Brussy, and the regimental staff entered the forester's office in Gatch. Here, an envoy of the 67th Russian Division was waiting for him. He asked us not to shoot and said that their soldiers were already disarmed and would not accept a fight. It was true. Everywhere, the advance was met by unarmed Russians, who happily saluted, and immense masses of soldiers who had been left in the lurch. In Brussy alone, there were 100 field kitchens. The magazines there were full to the roof, and a well-equipped field hospital with military doctors and nurses who looked clean and bright was also found. The whole forest between Gatch and Brussy was full of barracks and Russian camps. They were riddled with dirt and filth. About 150 soldiers still living there were collected and taken to Pronki.
So what happens in these three attacks then? You don't need name the names because there's lots of names no one's heard of, but, you know, give us an idea.
Yeah. Yes. Well, let's go north to south, because in the northern part of the attack, on the 18th of February, the 8th Army is divided into two forces and they go on the offensive. One force is advancing at Riga, which is from Riga, where they captured in September, we heard about last time. Another force known as the North Corps, the North Corps, is going from these islands, the Moonsound Islands, that were taken in Operation Albion. And they're just going into the Baltics at full speed. They're taking a lot of key cities. Tallinn in Estonia, then known as Revel, is taken on the 24th of February. On the 28th, the Riga group is pushing all the way up to a place called Pskov, and then the North group reaches Narva on the current border between Estonia and Russia. So that is quite far in this area. In the center, it's an attack towards Smolensk and Minsk. The center group, 10th Army, push on, and they quickly capture Smolensk within just 3 days, and then they reach and take Minsk, along with the entire headquarters of the Russian Western Front. So remember, this Russian army is divided into three fronts, and this is the headquarters of the Russian Western Front. So about a third of all the troops they have in that area is the headquarters for that is taken. In the southern sector, it's a combined offensive by the Germans and Austro-Hungarians, supported by these troops of this new Ukrainian People's Republic. They rush towards Kiev, crushing the remains of what was once the Russian Southwestern Front, which had caused them so much trouble during the Brusilov Offensive and the Kerensky Offensives in 1916 and 17. Then by the 2nd of March, they managed to reach and take Kiev. The gains here are completely unheard of. Just to illustrate the rapid advance, is Minsk was 250 kilometers from the front line when the offensive began on the 18th. So that's an advance of more than 80 kilometers a day from making use of railroads simply to push on. This is also part of this that would become known both here in German terminology, but also later on in the Civil Wars, this railroad wars, where you use the railroads to just move troops along. And we have a quote here from General Max Hoffmann, who we also heard from all the way back in episode one from the Battle of Tannenberg, describing this Operation Faustschlag.
It is the most comical war I've ever known. We put a handful of infantrymen with machine guns and one gun onto a train and rush them off to the next station. They take it, make prisoners of the Bolsheviks, pick up a few more troops and so on. This proceeding has, at any rate, the charm of novelty.
Yeah, it's a different kind of war. It's a very different kind of war than what we've seen so far. And the consequences is, of course, panic in the Bolshevik camps. They see the Germans just advancing. I mean, in the end, they're just 100 kilometers from Petrograd or St. Petersburg. The Bolsheviks move the capital to Moscow and make that the capital at this point because they're so threatened by this. So what do they do? How do they have to tackle it? Well, there's still some people who think that they should take up the fight again and go after them, and because they really, you know. But what can they do? The army is destroyed, and they still have to fight the whites in the oncoming war. So Lenin really steps in here, and through a lot of heated discussions in both the central committees and all his advisors and everything, they say, okay, we have to agree to these terms. We can't do anything else. And on the 3rd of March, they signed the Brest-Litovsk Treaty, withdrawing Russia from the war, at least on paper.
And just to make clear, the whites you mention are the Tsarists, the remnants of Tsarism.
Sometimes it could also be of the provisional government, which is not Tsarist, but of course,
No,
it's just very difficult to say who they are.
A right bunch. What's next? So the Brest-Litovsk is signed. Is it all over? Should we wrap up by saying thank you?
Well, Germany must now turn its attention to the West, surely. Western front, here we come.
Well, what happens is that almost immediately, as the ink is still wet on the paper, Germany starts getting involved in all these weird spin-off wars and conflicts in the East because the interests are still there for a lot of different things. And one of the first things that we see is that while all this has been going on, conflict has been brewing in Finland ever since this collapse of Tsarist rule. And in late January, as the Brest-Litovsk peace talks are taking place and breaking down and all this, war breaks out here again between whites, which is wants Finnish independence, and the Reds, which wants Bolshevik communist rule. And the whites request assistance from Germany. But the Germans don't really want to jeopardize peace talks. And initially, they're a bit hesitant as what to do with this. But when the Bolsheviks stall, they see, okay, maybe we can do something and start sending troops there. So their interest in this might seem a bit weird, but why do they want to do this and get involved in this? Well, Ludendorff, he is, of course, jointly in charge of the German army at this point. But he still has, you know, he has made his name in the East and he still has an eye on the East. And what he really wants is that if he can make something happen in Finland, he can continue to have a pressure on St. Petersburg as a guarantee that the Bolsheviks won't really do anything. And then he also has this sort of a dream of a German-led Finnish monarchy, sort of a puppet state kind of thing going on. So what they do is that on the 5th of March, the German land troops on the Åland Islands, which has actually already been captured by the Swedes, strangely enough, Sweden's little weird military contribution to this thing. Nothing happens there, but then they also land troops on the Finnish mainland shortly after and begin moving on Helsinki or Helsingfors, the capital of Finland, and take up the fight here with the Bolsheviks in the area. And we have an account here by Hauptmann Ernst Neumann of the 4th Jäger Battalion.
At 2:15 p.m., the good start. hope there's no difficult words to say in this, Gary.
Like the brigade PM.
The brigade received the order to attack Helsingfors. It marched to Berghall. The forest ended and the city lay before us. Gunfire sounded in the distance. Detachments of the White Guard were engaged in combat with the Red Guards. At 4:10 p.m., the 3rd Company, with battalion headquarters, advanced in column of one on both sides of the road. We came to the large building of the National Museum, behind which, on the other side of a wide plain, lay the Abo Barracks, from which heavy fire suddenly broke out without the enemy being visible. Covered by piles of stones, we went to the right into the inner city quarter, where new opponents received us in the same way. Individually, the companies pushed towards their prescribed goals in bitter street fighting. It was important for the assault party to reach the long road bridge to the red district of Saunas, which is separated from the city centre of the Tullasund. Individual shots are constantly being fired from the roof and cellar hatches. The resistance is broken and Henrik Street is reached opposite the student house. Strong fire from all sides shows that the centre of the city and the centre of resistance is approaching. The spearhead of the third company is engaged in a firefight with the Red Guards in the streets in front of the Swedish theatre. Immediately behind the Jaegers were the machine guns of the first machine gun company. The forwardmost half-platoon of Oberjäger Roth was covered and supported by the other machine guns of Wiesenfeldwebel's Hutik's platoon. Shut up, you two. In the middle of the firefight, out of nowhere, an armoured car approached the spearhead from a left side street at a distance of 5 to 10 metres. The Jaegers and the machine gunners managed at the last moment to avoid the armoured vehicle on the road. He aimed his machine gun turret at the machine gunners of Hutik's platoon, but due to the difficulty operating the machine gun in the car, Hutik's platoon suffered no casualties. Even though the machine gunners were kneeling in the middle of the street, completely without cover. Machine gunner Groman fired S ammunition. Now, I'm not sure what the S is standing for. It's an abbreviation.
It's a kind of ammunition. It's just a heavier sort of ammunition.
Slightly armour penetrating, I would imagine, from context. At the vision slits around the commander's seat, the planes of glass shattered. At full speed, the armoured car continued to advance along the street. Oberjäger Ruthie heard the shouts from the Jaegers. Armoured car from behind! The machine gun stopped firing instantly on the command, and the gunners dragged the gun off the road so as not to be run over by the armoured car approaching at high speed. Change of position. Hold fire. Otherwise, a Jaeger would be caught in the fire of their own machine guns. Order. Unload. Load SMK belt. Continuous fire, I presume, at the armoured car.
And other, yeah. No. And then the story is taken up by this Oberjäger Roth.
It all happened in the blink of an eye. I then ordered the gunners to lower their aim to use ricochets to damage the lower sensitive parts of the armoured car.
That Gary has lower sensitive parts.
The car was barely 40 metres away when an armour plate was penetrated and the car suffered severe damage in several places. It turned onto a street past the fire station where the Reds abandoned it. This is where it was later found. A dangerous opponent had been knocked out. Incessantly, for hours, he had made push after push against the advance towards the city. With his speed and a skillful back and forth in the street system he was familiar with, it was difficult to catch him. He presented a constant danger to Hauptmann Ott's detachment, which was engaged in heavy fighting. Fortunately, the high speed and the uncertain shooting associated with it had so far prevented major losses.
So, interesting street fighting, quite dramatic.
Yeah, both dramatic but also very different from what we've seen so far. These smaller engagements in a much more modern way that this is not what we normally associate with typical World War One era fighting, they managed to assist the Whites to a victory, and the civil war ends in May 1918, with a Finnish independence from Russia.
So that's that particular side alley dealt with. Anything else? There's other troubles, aren't there?
Yes. Moving away from this one sideshow, we're moving to the south because the war really continues there as well. The war there pretty much fails to end. Brest-Litovsk, the Bolsheviks have relinquished rights to southern Russia completely, and Germany and Austria is there to assist independent Ukraine. And what they really have their eyes on at this point is a few things. They want the oil fields in the Caucasus. They want the naval bases in on the Crimea, and they want, of course, to secure all this farmland that they can then you know, used to feed their population. So they start a drive to the Black Sea and capture Odessa. Following this breakthrough in the northern Ukraine, they swing south. They reach Odessa. There's some concern that this important port city is well defended by some 60,000 Bolshevik troops. These are not just small independent groups. These are quite sizable troop numbers. Remember, the number of troops already being, like, since Brest-Litovsk, they're already beginning to send troops westwards and to Italy. So 60,000 troops are a lot. But as soon as they are approached, they withdraw, and the city is taken on the 13th of May. Now, after taking Odessa, they sort of move along the coast with a repeated clashes with smaller groups of forces, and they swing eastwards along the coast. They capture another city we heard a lot about, Kherson, there's another long drive of repeated clashes along this road, and this is again a very different kind of war than what we normally see. And I just picked one example of this. This is the First War of the Bavarian Reserve Jäger Battalion. That's a long name. Fight in this city of Nikolaev, which is of course a very beautiful name for a city, today known as Mykolaiv. This is what happens there when they are ordered to move in to assist the 52nd Corps, which has already been there and is trapped there. And this is from the battalion's Oberstleutnant Martin Scheuring.
The train stopped in front of a second bridge over the Ingel River, which flows from the east into the Bug. This must be the River Bug at Nikolaev, as you just said, Nikolai. You could hear the gunfire and see shrapnel exploding over the city, and the railroad station district seemed particularly heavily shelled. The muzzle flashes could not be seen. From the sound, we estimated that the artillery was firing from northwest of Vodopol, a village just east of Nikolai. That's you. Enemy infantry was nowhere to be seen, but Cossack patrols roamed round Vodopol. An unexpected coincidence put us in contact with the endangered staff in the city. According to a Russian official, there was a telephone on the other side of the bridge. Lieutenant Thoman, the battalion adjutant, was lucky enough to be in contact with the staff of the 52nd Corps. Being able to communicate in English with a telephone operator, he learned that the staffs of 52nd Corps and the 217th Infantry Division were trapped in the Hotel London by Bolsheviks, and that the greatest haste was called for to rescue them. Wow.
Yeah. Mm. So the battalion is dispatched the battalion commander dispatches his companies to move into the city and to reach this Hotel London, which is located in the northern part of the city.
So this is Martin.
Yeah, he continues.
Led by Oberlieutenant Lutz, First Company entered the city with the battalion commander and battalion staff at the head. Near the entrance, in a narrow alley, the spearhead is met by rifle fire from the front, without the shooters being seen. Two machine guns are quickly brought into position, but unfortunately, both have loading problems. With rifles and pistols, the first defence is brought under fire from a cover behind a brick staircase. But as soon as the machine guns start firing, the enemy riflemen fall silent, very sensible of them. Twilight is already beginning to set in. The advance is rapid. Soon the suburbs are crossed and the actual city of Nikolaev begins. Now the houses are closer together, but the streets are unusually wide. The city echoes with rifle and machine gun fire mixed with cannon shots. The companies form single-file columns. One after another, they clear the middle of the street and nestle against the houses. It's gradually getting dark. The street can no longer be overlooked. The time for insidious battles. Enemy riflemen stand at every corner of the street, firing into the darkness. The bullets hit the pavement and the walls of the houses. Machine guns hammered on the street crossings from side streets. On our side, only the spearhead opens fire. They too can only shoot at the muzzle flashes in the dark, but they continue to advance. It is strictly forbidden to pause for too long. Onwards! Onwards! It's a constant command given by the battalion commander.
Yeah, and then they continue through the city, and then this strange thing happens to them. which happens a lot in these battles, but this is a good example of it.
A ghostly figure emerges from the darkness of the night with a pale face and gaunt limbs draped in a brown Russian hospital garb in a humble but dignified stance. I wonder if it was one of those hospital garbs with the backside showing. Do you know the ones I mean?
Humble but dignified.
Depends which way he's facing, really, doesn't it? So, through the interpreter, he explains to the battalion commander that he will take it upon himself to ensure that there will be no more firing on the enemy side if we stop firing too. He says he's moved by pure human love and that the misery he saw when he was sick in the hospital drove him to this decision. He wants to go on talking about human reconciliation. But in a street fight like this, there's no room for speeches and soft feelings. His speech is cut off by the question of whether he knows the way to the Hotel London. He agrees and is taken to the front. He walks between the battalion commander and Oberlieutenant Lutz. And now something quite unexpected happens. He gives a signal with a white rag. The fire stops, and at a call that sounds like an order, the shooters step out from their corners. All suspicious figures, none in uniform, all in civilian clothes with cartridge belts over their shoulders and with Russian rifles. They will be disarmed. Those who resist will be treated under martial law, and those willing will be taken captives. We are content with our guide, advancing and saving time and blood. Was it the Angel of Peace who entered the battlefield? Or was it the leader of the rebels who wanted to save a lost cause? The interpreter of the battalion commander says that it's the latter. Yeah, there's a word missing, which I should have been able to work out for myself. But I'm unrelated.
Now, right. At this point, and to give Pete a rest after all that hard work, we'll take a short break.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Now, what's happening elsewhere? What's happening in the Crimea?
Yeah, so with the southern coast, the Black Sea coast secured, the Central Park can move on to the Crimea. So, already here, Crimea is considered to be territory belonging to the new Ukrainian Republic, and And the objective here is really to take Crimea and seize the Russian Black Sea Fleet, which is still a massive fleet lying in Sevastopol. That is the main objective for the Central Powers at this point. They moved quickly across the peninsula and really meet almost no resistance. And on the 1st of May, they managed to capture Sevastopol without any fighting. And we have another quote here by an officer of the 9th Reserve Infantry Regiment, which is just found interesting because of both the connection to other parts of the war and history as well.
Sevastopol, one has a somewhat vague idea of it from school. 1853-56, Crimean War, bloody battles at Inkerman on the Malakhov, heroic defence, finally conquest because the gigantic empire without railroads could not get reinforcements there in time. The harbour entrance, the harbour in general, is said to be one of the most beautiful in Europe. The Russian ships no longer entertain the idea of moving out. The next day, those who were under steam were occupied by us. First, vast quantities of food and stolen valuables were seized, especially from the merchant ships. The keepers of these treasures, Bolsheviks with their girlfriends, were imprisoned for the time being. The entire Black Sea fleet, apart from two capital ships that had moved out and a few torpedo boats, were in the so-called warship port and torpedo boat and submarine port, completely filling the harbour. On the second day of our stay, the famous Gerben arrived from Constantinople. We saw her come in. The promenade opposite was black with people, Russians and soldiers of the 3rd 9th. The regimental band played Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles. The hurrahs of the sailors and soldiers sounded loudly across to us. Our hearts were filled with proud joy. Our Turkish Gerben!
It must have been. It must have got better because it was. We badly damaged it in 1918, didn't we?
Yes, we had.
Anyway, it was up and about again. Anyway, so what now?
Well, with Crimea taken, why not continue? So they continue a push into the eastern part of Ukraine now. And while things are going on with the German and Austro-Hungarian forces there, also Austro-Hungarian and German forces are moving eastwards into the Ukrainian mainland. The Germans move into the northeast, concentrating on capturing the second capital, Kharkov, which has been the center of power for the Ukrainian Soviet Republic, and managed to take it on the 10th of April. The Austro-Hungarians then move in the southeastern direction. They take the Donetsk basin and reach the Sea of Azov and take the port of Mariupol on the 28th of April. So you can hear, again, a lot of names that we hear a lot about today as well. And the Central Powers continue this push all the way to the Don River, with the Germans taking the port city of Tangarok on the 1st of May and Rostov on the Don on the 8th. And this is really where the advance comes to a sort of an end. And it's also where we see some of the last fights of Austria-Hungary on the 5th of May. Some ships show up outside of Mariupol and the Austro-Hungarians fire at them and chase them off. And this is actually considered broadly to be the last Austro-Hungarian action on the Eastern Front of the war. And then from there on, they will move all their focus onto the Italian front. I mean, was it? Don't know. There might be others, but that is what the official history of Austria-Hungary of the war says and declares. That's where the war ended in the east for the Austro-Hungarians. It doesn't actually end there. And it's also important to say that there are still battles being fought, and there are quite large battles being fought at this place, Taganrog, which lies down by the Sea of Azov. In mid-June, there's several Bolshevik attempts to launch attacks and offensives to gain territory across the Don River. One of the largest ones is that they actually make a sort of almost amphibious landing at Taganrog. They land some 12,000 troops outside the city on the 10th of June, and they march on the city, which is just held by a few German regiments, a couple of Württemberg regiments. But they're just completely annihilated by machine gun fire, by rifle fire, by well-coordinated artillery fire. And by the 12th of June, the remnants retreat and they leave some 8,000 to 9,000 killed or wounded behind. And this is one of the last major battles of the war in the East. But it's also to show that the Bolsheviks are also trying to launch some offensives, and there are actually what we can say is not just skirmishes being fought at this point.
So where are we now then? So what about any other fronts where there? So
yes, surprisingly yes. So we can continue. But yes. So amazing. While this is happening, and while they're fighting in Ukraine, another state is asking, a newly independent state is asking for German help. And this is the Democratic Republic of Georgia, which proclaimed independence in May 1918, as a pro-German republic, which is a bit of an odd decision in May 1918, perhaps, to declare yourself a fully pro-German republic. But they do that because they want help with a particular ally of the Germans, which is the Turks. And, of course, the Bolsheviks, with the Germans already fighting. So Germany sends an expedition to Georgia in June. This is known as the Caucasus Expedition. It's some 3,000 men, which are sent to help repel the Bolshevik forces. And aid the Georgian army or the various militias and independence forces there. But there are also, there's a lot of these internal fight going on, but Germany's focus is that they want to take and seize the oil fields around Baku. This is also something that we hear in the Second War, that this is a focus point of this, and an objective. The problem here is that this is also a major objective for the Bolsheviks and for the Turkish. They are all moving in on this area and trying to seize it first. So, of course, we know that Turkey and Germany are allies, but here we have this clash between the old allies, because the Turks, they're supporting some Muslim groupings in the Caucasus, in an area that is traditionally more Christian. They're still fighting going on with the Armenians, clashes with German aspirations, and this is just a whole mix of things. And it actually leads to a couple of times where there is fighting between Turkish and German forces here. But let's just have a quote here by the guy we heard from before, Oberstleutnant Martin Schöring, of the 1st Royal Bavarian Reserve Jäger Battalion.
Kurds and Tatars, Muslim tribes, were from the south within a day's march of the gates of Tiflis. A wild panic had set in Tbilisi. Many Georgians and almost all rich Armenians had fled Tbilisi, and the end of the young Georgian state was imminent when the fanatical hordes overran Tbilisi. He keeps saying Tbilisi. He's just trying to make... The worst thing about it was that these hordes did not appear independently. They were the pace setters of the regular Turkish troops. First, the 11th Turkish Division, which had been deployed along the Alexandropol-Tiflis Railway, and west of it in the valley of Vronskovy, Catherinesfeld, and Elizabethtal. Gary, I'll be having a word with you after this.
Well done.
Since June 10th, acted on Tbilisi. It was an open secret. Stop saying Tbilisi. In Tbilisi. That the gangs were being led by Turkish officers who, of course, kept in the background as much as possible, but whose presence was denied by the Turkish military attaché in Tbilisi and the Turkish commission. According to their verbatim assurances, there were no Turkish troops on the South Georgian soil at all.
You did really well, Pete, but I think it's Tbilisi.
Yeah, but as I said before, there are actually skirmishes being fought between the Germans and the Turkish forces here, which leads to some diplomatic conflict between Constantinople, Istanbul, and Berlin, threatening to withdraw all military aid and troops from the Ottoman Empire, leading the Turks to really relocate and redirect their forces to Persia. So this is just to mention that the First World War in the East is more complicated and multifaceted than we sometimes think. But maybe we should return to Ukraine a bit. This is an offshoot. I just think it's an interesting part that we really find it weird that German troops are marching through Georgia in the First World War.
Marching through Georgia?
Sounds like a song.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe a different Georgia, but I mean, sorry.
Yeah. So the Germans are helping Ukraine, or do they occupy Ukraine?
Well, the thing is that they, of course, are officially there to help Ukraine in their independence. But what their real focus is, of course, securing the flow of foodstuffs through the homeland. And there's a lot of violence. There's a lot of harsh treatment of the population. This is aggravated by the fact that the central group don't really manage to get all the food that they want. The bread piece when they sign it, it's expected that they will be able to provide them with 1 million trainload of grain in the first year. But because they don't have rolling stock, they have a bad yields. There's a destroyed farmlands from the fighting going across this area. It means that the actual thing that they actually get is just 11,000 cars to send westwards.
So the bread piece was little more than a piece of bread.
Oh, God. You might say that.
if you were totally half-witted, I think we'd agree with it.
Yes, exactly. Just to point out what this is, we have a letter here from a Danish-German soldier. We've talked about this, the Danish minority within the German armies. Beautiful name again, Nikolai Nissen, in the Ukraine. He's writing to his wife on the 3rd of July, 1918, about what he's witnessing there and what he thinks of the mission that he's on there.
Today, two Ukrainians will be shot again. They probably had guns in the house, may even shot as soldiers. And then there's, of course, no mercy. I must confess that I cannot find justice in it. Martial law is not right, in my opinion. The Germans will be remembered long after as liberators. If it is liberation to send people over to the beyond, if it is liberation to take their grain, which they use for fodder, etc., I resent such things. And then the divisional priest can deliver a nice sermon on the text, "Those who are driven by the Spirit of God are God's children." And so by God's Spirit is meant the German Spirit, and by God's children, the German soldiers who have come here to bring order and peace to the unhappy country. A terrible sermon. There are so many incomprehensible things here. Above all, I cannot understand that we have to come here to help the people who for hundreds of years have used their power to cow and oppress an entire people. I cannot pity the gentlemen who now have to give up some of their rights, which they have basically usurped. I don't think that the big men here, the landowners and the capitalists, care much for the Ukrainian people. If they did, they would not have summoned strangers to beat down their own people. They'd probably made sure to set the record straight, instead of taking everything for themselves. There's no trace of law and justice. One of the men who is now to be shot is the father of five children, has worked for a farmer and earned 2 rubles a day. A pound of bread costs at least 1 ruble here. He had then said that he should have something more, but had been threatened. "Yes," he said, "then I'll run home and get my gun and shoot you." But he'd not done so. The other had identified him, and now he was sentenced to death. Is it justice? It boils in my mind at the thought of such a thing. Not any more today. I can't write for pure anger. I wish I could do something to prevent all of this.
Those Danish Germans are lovely.
Mm. Yeah. But you can also see signs that it's not just in the Russian army that this idea of communism, of socialism is taking hold. It's also taking hold among some of the soldiers serving there. And this is going to, of course, play a part in both what happens next and in the years to come in Germany when these men come home. So
where are we now?
We are, of course, approaching the end. As we said, there are some scattered fighting here and there going on, but the front is now pretty much set in the east. and things that are playing out in the West as we know them, that we are not going to talk about. But of course, reaching into November, things start to happen. They begin to hear things, that things are not going as well on other fronts. The soldiers there start to hear talk of revolution at home and all this, and we're reaching the end of the war, sort of. But of course, being that these men are not just on the other side of the border, these are hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away from home. The war is nearly over, and you don't really know what's going on, which means there's a breakdown in discipline, there's a breakdown in morale, and these soldiers do not just have a way to just march home. And we have a couple of picked, again, here mainly the Danish Germans, because they give really good accounts of this particular period. And we have a few here to show what it is. The first one here, we have Schleswig Danish soldiers called Willy B. I don't know his last name. He didn't sign it in the account he left on. And he is writing on the situation in and around Kiev in late 1918, early 1919. So already here we can see that the war is not just ending in 1918 for these men.
We'd gradually reached the autumn of 1918. For a long time, we were well aware that the war was nearing its end, and everyone knew that it was the Germans who would come out of the war as the losers. The soldiers were tired of waging war. People suffered hardship, and the homesickness was great. Discipline disappeared. Detachments and units demoralized. It was a result of the daily influence of the Bolsheviks. But voices were also heard from the other side. One day we had an experience connected with the revolution in Germany. A train coming from the Black Sea city of Sebastopol ran into the station and had a short stop to fill water on the engine. It was a pretty long train. The wagons were full of German sailors. They sang and were so happy because now they had to go home and help with the revolution. Red flags were also brought. The carriages were painted over with very telling images. I remember one of the wagons in particular. President Wilson and Kaiser Wilhelm were seen, the Emperor standing upright and receiving the well-known 14 points from the President's outstretched hand. The President was in a dress, striped trousers and a top, I think he means dress coat. I'm guessing. Striped trousers and a top hat. Yeah, dress coat by context. The Bolsheviks had surrounded the city. They lay there waiting for us to evaporate. Our troops were completely demoralized. They left their posts thinking they could go home. Many of them tried to reach Kiev. But when they came back, they looked completely changed. Amongst other things, I saw a bearded gentleman, one of our Landsturm, who came wandering back wearing only a pair of underpants. The Russians had looted him to the skin before letting him run back. And it's funny the way that the German, the Bolsheviks, it's all changed over, hasn't it? One minute they're just retreating, they're not resisting, and when they do resist, they're slaughtered. But now it's all over. And they're
just waiting. Yeah, they're just waiting for things to happen. We have another account here. This is another Danish soldier. He's called Hans Schmidt. And he ends the war between Kiev and Poltava, another connected to a name that we probably heard from. And this might be a little weirdly worded. It was from a quote from a Danish radio program on the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. And he mumbles quite a bit. So I tried to translate it as well as I could.
Shall I mumble then?
Should I?
We received no letters and heard nothing from home for 3 months. We heard a few things over the army radio, and we heard that there was about to be a revolution in Germany, but we did not know when. When the last men to return to us from leave arrived around November, we asked them if Wilhelm was now a civilian. And when we were told that the Emperor had abdicated, we revolted. We set up soldier councils and demoted the officers, a great pleasure for an old German soldier, especially since our first lieutenant was a drunk. I was made head of the council, and we went to the first lieutenant and told him that he was no longer in charge. We took away his 3 servants and 2 horses and told him to eat from the same pot as us. He thought that was fair enough. However, in other places where they had better and more capable officers, it was more dramatic. There, the officers were simply chased off. But when we were marching home and the transport was attacked by Bolshevik gangs, the men quickly realised that discipline was necessary and returned to their bosses and pleaded for them to take back command. They usually agreed, but demanded complete loyalty, to which the soldiers replied, "Well, naturally."
I like that quote, Nicola.
Yeah, it's a good quote.
Now, yeah. Let's get distances in our head. Not exactly, but it's a long way home, isn't it? I mean, This is not like, you know, walking from East Finchley to Tottenham.
But no, like, I mean, a lot of these soldiers will not arrive home until January or February 1919. Of course, the only way they can really do it is that they begin to transport the ones who are furthest away are transported out first and then moved away so that they can sort of cover their retreat and not leave. If the first ones left and just left the rest, it would be a problem. So that's what they're trying to do. But of course, it's good to remember that they're also caught in the middle of someone else's war. These soldiers are not really, they're still sort of German soldiers, but are they? And are they in some weird revolution now or whatever? Certainly they're not fighting anybody, but they're in the middle of this. And the Ukrainians hate them because of what we heard before, that they've exploited their country. The Bolsheviks hate them because they've been fighting them for a long time. So it's just a mess. We have another soldier here, another Danish soldier called Søren Lauesen. He's from the 4th Landstone Battalion.
When the war ended, we found ourselves in the Ukraine. It was not amusing under these conditions to be surrounded by a hostile population. The journey home was not so easy either. While we'd elected a soldiers' council under these conditions, then the officers nevertheless retained command. That's what the previous bloke said. The officers, you know.
Yes.
We wanted to go home at any cost. The battalion had to provide its own means of transport. And we had also requisitioned a train stock. But then we missed the locomotive. When we wanted to get one of these, we came into conflict with a so-called, now I don't know who these are, Petilurius. Who are they?
They're Ukrainians.
Ukrainians, yeah.
They're loyal to a Ukrainian independence commander.
Got it. So they discovered our Bolshevik tendencies, because, of course, these Germans have been infiltrated by communism. They simply demanded that we disarm first. But we weren't too keen on that for some reason. The episode resulted in shooting here and there. And before we looked around, there was scattered skirmishing going on. We lost quite a few. The Petiluria troops called for reinforcements. And in the afternoon, due to overwhelming superiority, we had to lay down our rifles. Now, a court had to be established, and the opponents demanded that every third man be shot as a countermeasure. After some negotiation, they agreed to shoot only every tenth man. The end of the story, however, was that all officers were detained, after which the battalion was allowed to steam off as we got hold of a locomotive, which in the dead of night pulled the train in the direction of Germany. The transport was terrible because of the cold and unhygienic conditions. We experienced a new episode the following afternoon. At one of the stations, we passed an oncoming train of Russian prisoners of war coming from Germany. Oh, dear. They immediately discovered what kind of people we were, and before long they were forcing us to trade clothes with them. At the same time, they robbed us of all our valuables, and what was even worse, they took all our food. Wow. They're just, everybody hates them.
Yeah, exactly. I just wanted to finish on one quote, and I think it's fascinating the context of this one, because this soldier, another Danish soldier, he's called Christian Johansen. He is one of the first soldiers to enter Belgium in August 1914, and he fights at Mons, and he finds himself ending the war in the Caucasus in Georgia. The journey for him is just immense. He then takes off as they're sailed out towards Sevastopol from the east, as I said, moving from east to west.
Our mission seemed accomplished, and we sailed back to Sevastopol. Here we were met with disappointment. The railway would not transport us. After a lot of negotiations, we re-embarked and sailed to Odessa, the port city in Ukraine. Due to mines, it was a dangerous voyage. In Odessa lay a large Russian warship with a German crew. From the bridge of the ship, a private marine spoke to us and told us that there was a revolution in Germany. Now, it was us ordinary soldiers who determined the pace. Jürgen and I were then elected to the Soldiers' Council for the 4th Company. Our company commander was allowed to lead the company home. The other three company commanders were demoted. Then came the trip home, and sadly, it was almost the worst of the whole war. We still had all our equipment, field kitchen, horses, machine guns, and a large box of rubles, which helped us well when we first started. The new Ukrainian government had arranged it so that each company travelled alone and one day apart. Finally, it was our turn. It was slow, and we had to bribe the railway staff from station to station. We had a whole wagon full of wheat flour, which we thought we'd also make good use of at home. But when we drove into a major railway station one morning, it was surrounded by military with artillery. We negotiated for several hours, but to no avail. Since we would not be able to cope against their superior force, we had to get rid of everything we had. Then we could drive on without weapons, but with food for 2 days. We were given a military force with us as protection, but it soon evaporated. It got worse and worse with the transport. The railway staff demanded more and more, and we had almost nothing left. Then, one evening, we reached Novokrantsky. At 12 o'clock, half of the train was uncoupled, and the front carriages in which we were sitting drove away. After 20 minutes had passed, we heard some shots and the train stopped. "Now it's over for us," said Jürgen. We looked out through a crack in the wagon and saw that a sled with armed bandits was pulling up next to us. The carriage doors were pushed open. "Hands up!" And 6 men armed with revolvers stripped us of everything we still had left. Jürgen and I brought some tobacco from the Caucasus. I also had some rubles sewn into the clothes, but everything disappeared. They even took my good boots and foot clothes, so I was left barefoot in the cold winter. Then we were driven back and the train was coupled together. Our comrades, who had remained at the railway station, had also been looted. At last we drove on, and luckily we met an artillery transport at a railway station, which still had their weapons. Most of us joined this transport, thinking that now all was well. But when we approached Bucharest, the artillery commander told us that in Bucharest all Mackensen's forces were interned. We had to get through. All wagons were sealed and we were ordered to keep calm. Our driver bribed the railwayman with thousands of rubles and we entered the railway station in Bucharest as a goods train. Here it was French soldiers who had the power. We saw them time and time again going over the tracks. We were anxious to see if we could get through. At once we drove and soon we were out in the countryside. We got through to Munich and from here I could send a telegram home.
Wow. And now is it over?
So now it's over. I think we can declare it over. But of course, we have to remember that the war in the East didn't really stop here for everybody. It stopped for the Germans, stopped for the Austro-Hungarians. Of course, there would be a number of successive wars in Austria-Hungary as well. And the war in Russia, the Russian Civil War is going to go on for a long time and claim even more lives than the entire First World War did for Russia. So yes, but I think we can declare that the part that is sort of what we would consider the First World War in the East is over at this point. And I think that I hope that it's given the listeners both an insight into what this is all about, because as we said to begin with, it's a complicated topic that we don't hear much about, especially some of these later episodes. It's really not covered very well, and I hope that it's been inspired people to look a bit more into it and do some research themselves.
Well, we would thank you, Nikolai, and if you do want to know more, perhaps you could visit Nikolai's Twitter account, which, what's the handle for that?
It's at PipeGrey1418.
Where you'll find lots of really interesting stuff. It really is fantastic. You do an awful lot of work, Nikolai, and you know, two lazy people like me and Pete You know, we've got to be really grateful for the work that you've put into these podcasts.
Well, we've learned so much. We've learned so much, haven't we, Gary, from this?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that things were happening simultaneously. So whilst the Somme is happening on the Western Front, you know, something equally huge in magnitude is happening on the Eastern Front. And you just don't think about it. You don't hear about it. So I've learned an awful lot, mainly not to work with Pete.
Yeah. Thank you, Gary. Thanks a lot, Nikolai. You are brilliant.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support us, you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah, blah.
Visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?